have a deal potentially very close. He wants to make it much more than I want to make it. I'm not anxious to make it. We're taking in hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs. We never took in 10 cents.
Look, the president actually follows a lot of the companies that report earnings. Almost all the calls there is, just particularly in retail, people are moving away from China. When he hears this, he wants to string it out. He keeps thinking that the longer this goes on, the more the companies move from China, which increases his leverage.
We're not seeing a lot of actual movement toward what the White House likes to call a phase one trade deal. The Chinese have invited the top trade negotiator in the U.S., Robert Lighthizer, to come to Beijing for further talks, and he declined. Trump said yesterday that the Chinese aren't giving him what he wants. There's a lot of obstacles here that need to be overcome in a very short period of time. A new tranche of tariffs is supposed to go into effect on December 15th. And I just don't see it happening. In fact, if I had to bet on any outcome right now, I would bet that Donald Trump doesn't sign any trade deal with the Chinese before his reelection campaign.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, a lot of news making the market this week. Most of it was in Washington, where we had impeachment hearings. The Fed injecting liquidity in the market. Market seems to like it. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Jonathan Krinsky from Baycrest Partners will join us, and he says everything's kicking in on all cylinders. He's got a few sectors he thinks are about to break out. You're going to want to hear what he has to say on that. And then Dave Morgan also will be joining me later on in the broadcast as we take a look at the commodity markets, and we're looking at silver. The gold-to-silver ratio is the highest it's been in history. It's at 86. You want to hear about the implications with that. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. And Chris and I will talk later on in the big picture, the liquidity rush, as this week the Fed poured $102 billion of liquidity into the financial markets. All of that coming up on today's program.
Well, there's so much happening in the markets. This week, we saw a lot of nervousness, and yet the market continues to do so well. Well, we'd like to welcome back to the studio Ryan Poplava to talk about that exact thing. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks, Chris. You know, just recapping from last week, we talked about quite a few different things, but trade uncertainty was the main issue and catalyst for the market. And I'd say the same thing this week. You know, the headlines have been kind of back and forth that a deal will get done or it won't. And just looking, we got comments from all of the major players. But Trump got the final word at the end of this week on Friday when he told Fox News that the U.S. and China are potentially very close to a deal. So we're adding some more vague terminology there. But didn't agree with President Xi that the trade deal must be equal because the U.S. should have a better deal, is what he told Fox News. Interestingly, the market took off on those words and then paired some of those gains Friday to try and see if the S&P 500 could close positive on the week, but not quite. You know, the S&P 500 is up 6 weeks in a row. Now, had to take a break. Had to take a breather.
Well, Ryan, you've said that trade headlines have been back and forth this week, but what were some of the negative headlines that appeared to have sown some doubt over the process? I think the original plan, and it was announced on October 11th, it was for the U.S. and China to sign something this month at the summit in Chile. But that doesn't look to be the case, especially after Chile canceled due to protests.
Yeah, they did. So there hasn't been an agreement at the end of October. It sounded like, hey, we've got a date in store. But no, you know, the consolidation in equities kind of began, as I said last week. It really, there was some back and forth headlines that said that, you know, a trade deal is likely not going to get done, that the Chinese want to see more tariff rollbacks. Same message this week. In fact, there was a tweet from Eunice Yoon at CNBC, one of the anchors there who focuses on China, tweeted that the government source that she knew of told her the mood in Beijing about a trade deal is pessimistic because there haven't been any announced tariff rollbacks from Trump. Again, We heard that last week. So, the stock market didn't budge too much on that news because there is still an underlying belief that there will be a trade agreement. Morgan Stanley later in the week thinks a phase one deal will be as good as it gets, that there's really going to be no phase two. And they are still doubtful, given that more tariffs are anticipated to kick in on December 15th for mainly consumer goods. And I think going forward near term, that will be the date to watch for, Chris, for a deadline on phase one, in my opinion. It's like this another, we heard it back in October, there were supposed to be some tariffs that were supposed to go into effect. That got some trade discussions to go solidly put together, a rollback in those, and we didn't get them. So maybe this will happen as well. December 15th, I think, is the date to watch. But besides the CNBC tweet on Monday, the U.S. Senate passed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. Recall that the House passed, I don't know if it was the same version or something similar about a month ago or so, where the Chinese said that, they threatened that if we passed it in the Senate and Trump ratified it, that they would retaliate. So now it goes to Trump. So two more headlines that have instilled doubt was a Reuters report Wednesday that the phase one deal might get pushed into next year. And again, that puts the September 15 tariff right in effect. And that's something that could potentially become a stumbling block for the consumer economy, our consumer economy. And it appears that if I could sum up all of the phase one issues in one, it's that the Chinese want rollbacks on tariffs, but the U.S. want them there to drive compliance. So we don't have an agreement, even though they said they did a month ago.
Well, the market really doesn't seem to be reacting as poorly as it did in May, and that's when the trade tariffs escalated and trade talks collapsed. I think the S&P 500, if I'm not mistaken, it was down around 5% after that, but we're barely down this week at all, which it factors probably into that Bank of America Merrill Lynch study that you mentioned last week, reporting cash levels are dropping, but it's fueling the FOMO trade, or fear of missing out. But Ryan, were there any other headlines or catalysts this week besides trade that you'd like to talk about?
Well, Chris, there was a lot going on with the retail stocks this week, with quite a few different earnings reports that we should probably get into. That didn't have a great effect overall on the stock market in general, but it was definitely something that I think we're heading into the retail season, and it's important to get an idea for our consumer-driven economy, because that's widely what has really supported the growth in the stock market, in addition to an accommodative Fed. But the other issue, Charles Schwab just announced, or there's been some ideas that they're going to be picking up TD Ameritrade. And this is as a result, if you look at for them in the whole industry, going down to a $0 trade, that's not on everything. There's still mutual funds, bonds, et cetera, that they're probably going to make some transactional dollars off of, but on equities, $0. And if they're getting this, if this is happening, they're losing the revenue from that part of the volume, they're directing trade and getting revenue that way. Then there's there's possibly going to be this consolidation on the industry. Charles Schwab, the number one asset gatherer, Fidelity is second, Ameritrade third. That makes a combined Schwab and Ameritrade a very, very big player. So many are saying this was a direct result of the drop in trade revenue from ticket charges, but Schwab has gained 142,000 accounts in October due to the move, setting their assets under management at a new record of around $3.85 trillion.
I have to mention that Chris Sheridan did a great, great interview on November 19th about a lot of that shift in what brokers are charging. The show is called Evolution of the Commission Shift. So for listeners out there that would like to even hear more about that, it's a good, between 30 and 40 minutes just on that, and it includes all the history, just on FS Insider.
Well, back to retail. That was the other thing I'd like to go over is let's take a look at some of the key earnings this week. There was just some broad stroke weakness on Tuesday in the industry that came from disappointing earnings and guidance from Home Depot and also Kohl's, which hit other retailers pretty hard. The retail spider ETF, I think it's XRT, fell 1.9% on the news and fell more on Wednesday due to the trade news that I previously mentioned. There was a lot of that, so which one? The trade news about essentially a postponement of a trade deal into next year. Again, essentially setting in that important date of December 15th on consumer goods, that tariff that could hit. That would definitely hurt some of the retailers. But interestingly, on the same day, rallying on good earnings and guidance from Target and Lowe's that helped that ETF finish only down 1.2% on Wednesday. So 1.9% on Tuesday, 1.2% on Wednesday. Decent move in retail stocks. Then Friday, hey, Nordstrom's was up nicely to join in on that kind of late week rally with better than feared results. Summing up here, Chris, you know, there's what's ahead. You know, it's going to be interesting, the retail season this year, as there's the specter of that December 15th tariff, as we think maybe phase one deal, maybe is it further out? It's a very big possibility because there's no middle ground right now between, you know, the U.S. wanting to keep those tariffs to maintain compliance, and then the Chinese wanting them rolled back. In addition, Chinese getting a little upset about us being involved in Hong Kong in any way, even just talking about it. But there's good guidance overall from several of the big name retailers that I already mentioned this week, assisting in the view that the U.S. is really doing just fine. You know, there's low unemployment right now, 3.6%, falling interest rates, making it easy to borrow, big returns in the stock market, helping everyone with that wealth effect that Bernanke loved, and elevated consumer confidence should, all just help to drive the consumer-led economy, should help us to do just fine. And then there's the National Retail Federation, which projected, I think last month, that we'll see better growth this season. So far, they're estimating around growth of 3.8% in November and 4.2% in December over last year. And last year, they had projected almost as high, maybe a little bit higher, but we didn't do so well because, remember, we had that 20% market, you know, that bear market. So this December so far shaping up to be better than last year. But and that report's excluding autos, gas, and restaurants. But, you know, we'll continue to sway, I think, back and forth on equities based on trade headlines, but not very much because, like I said, there's that maybe fear of missing out. You've got positioning. You've got I've been looking at put-to-call ratios, which we put in our investment minutes this week. It should be on the website, kind of talking about, you know, a lot of major firms are rolling back their hedges, allowing for their portfolios to have market returns. Interestingly, there was that really big article about Ray Dalio, wasn't it?
That was an eye-opening article. My initial reaction was alarm.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're not net short, but they've put on a very large put position. This stoked Ray Dalio to immediately tweet to the effect saying that, hey, he's not net bearish. Okay, yeah, that's one part of the message, but if you really did buy a lot of those puts, then you really are putting at least a hedge.
Yeah, it looks like you can read that article both ways, but he really tried to make himself clear through a series of subsequent tweets. Ryan, thanks again. I mean, you've really brought a lot of color to what's going on in the market, as you always do. I do want to let our listeners know that next week's show, we will not have a market wrap unless something market-moving happens. If there's big news, well, we'll be here. We may have a market wrap for you. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
If these online brokers are not charging for trades, how are they making their money?
Oh, they have a lot of ways to make money. For one thing, if you really pay attention to these, they've cut the fees on equity trades. So stocks and exchange traded funds are now zero to trade, to buy or sell. That's nice. That most of them are still charging a per contract fee for options. So there's still a fee from the low end of 10 cents a contract at e-option up to about 65 or 75 cents a contract at most of the other brokers. Some are charging 50 cents a contract. So it's under a dollar a contract basically to place an options trade. But it's still something. And also, if you are opening a mutual fund position, there are a lot of mutual funds now that you'll pay a certain amount just to place your first order of whatever the minimum is. It might be $5,000. You might pay $50 for that. If you are still in mutual funds rather than exchange traded funds, that's something to look for when you're reading the prospectus before you open a new position in a mutual fund. And then the other thing to look at is you're still paying for margin if you trade on margin.
you know that municipal bonds can provide you with a predictable source of income that is free from both federal and state income taxes? If you're in a high tax bracket, municipal bonds could be the right investment choice for you. If you have more than $500,000 to invest, our portfolio managers can create a municipal bond portfolio designed to align with your financial goals. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939 now and add tax-free bonds to your portfolio. That's 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the rally on Wall Street continues as the Fed pours liquidity into the markets. It's been a good year for investors. I don't care where you look. International stocks, domestic stocks, small cap, large cap, bonds, stocks, commodities. Well, some commodities anyway. Will this rally continue? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Jonathan Krinsky from Baycrest Partners. Jonathan, let's talk about overall the markets right now. Let's begin with the S&P breaking out to record levels, as many of the indexes are. Give us your take from the 40,000-foot level.
Yeah, so I think 40,000-foot level, we have to recognize that the entire global equity market, and S&P included, made a high back in January of 2018. It has then spent nearly 2 years going, for all intents and purposes, sideways. Now, S&P has done a bit better than that, but if we're just talking global equities, really hasn't made much progress in almost 2 years. So I think from that top-down perspective, we have to be under the assumption that we're now starting to emerge higher from that base. And I think that's why the resilience has been so impressive. You know, it's not that we're at the tail end of this massive rally. Yes, we've come a long way this year, and from the lows that we saw last December, it's been a pretty impressive rally. I think S&P is up over 20% on the year, so that would suggest that we're probably due for a pause. But again, if you look at that big picture, we really haven't made much progress since January of 2018, so that suggests that we could just be getting going here on this new breakout. Now, if we come in a little bit shorter term, we are, by many metrics, maybe a little overbought, and I also think sentiment needs to be reset. One of the things we look at for short-term sentiment is we look at the put-call ratios, and we look at a 10-day moving average of those, and those have gotten way down to pretty much the lowest levels we've seen in the last year or two. So that suggests there's not much fear out there. People aren't really hedging or protecting, and oftentimes once you get that type of complacency, you can see a bit of a reset or a pullback. So that's kind of what we're thinking, a little bit of a pullback here into December, and then that could set up a nice year-end rally.
Let's talk about a new term. You know, you've heard TINA, there is no alternative, meaning the stock market. And then there's also one that's thrown out that could influence the end of the year, which is FOMO, fear of missing out. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that we saw that a bit in the last couple weeks, and that's goes hand in hand with those put call ratios that I've been talking about. So, you know, not only are people not buying as many puts as they have been, but they're buying more calls. So that brings the put call ratio down. So people are reaching for upside. They're buying some of the more speculative stocks, and really that fear of missing out has certainly been prevalent. And I think that also is why the dips have been so small, because, you know, I think maybe a lot of people are waiting for the pullback, and when it doesn't come, then they kind of raise their buy orders and kind of chase things to the upside. So that's certainly a bit prevalent, and I don't think that, you know, we're going to see anything like we saw last December. That was certainly a once-in-a-generation type of December move. But again, I think we could see a little bit of a shakeout, and then that would be a nice entry point.
Let's talk about within the S&P for pretty much most of this year. It was sort of defensive sectors with the exception of technology. You saw, for example, consumer discretionary or staples. You saw REITs, you saw utilities, and then, of course, there was technology. Now you're starting to see financials lift off, and let's also talk about healthcare and industrial. So we're now starting to see some alternative sectors start to take off.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of money that had gone into the bond proxies or the high dividend areas, and there were a lot of fears that an economic slowdown was coming, and it did a little bit, but I think that's now abating somewhat. So we're seeing some relative underperformance from some of the bond proxies and some relative outperformance from some of the more cyclical areas. You mentioned financials, industrials, and then healthcare is kind of straddles the line sometimes between value or growth. There's a lot of different aspects in healthcare, but I think if we look at it overall, broadly speaking, it really was one of the worst performing sectors this year up until a few weeks ago. And, you know, whether that was political uncertainty for the upcoming election, whatever the reason, that started to reverse as well. And we're seeing breakouts. The overall S&P 500 healthcare sector just broke out of its trading range to a new all-time high. And we're seeing biotechs actually start to perform better, trying to break out of their recent downtrend. So a lot of interesting stuff happening below the surface. And I think that's, you know, more interesting to us than the overall S&P, which continues to make slow upside progress. But it's really just churning here as we see an underlying rotation under the surface.
Now, another sector you have with the possible breakout, and this speaks well about the economy, and that is hotels. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, hotels, smaller group within consumer discretionary, but they, have just been kind of biding their time like a lot of other parts of the market, but we're starting to see some breakouts in some of the more recognizable hotel names, Hilton, Hyatt, Marriott. They all look pretty good to us. Again, nice, strong structural uptrends, and they've consolidated for really the better part of 2 years and are now, you know, I think are primed to start to emerge higher here as we head into 2020.
So let's talk about another sector of the market, and that is treasuries. We saw the yields get down to August to some of the lowest levels we've seen since 2016. Now we've got that 10-year climbing. It's on the day you and I are speaking, it's around 1.7. But it got as high as almost 1.85. What are the risks to the market if, let's say, treasury yields begin to climb?
Yeah, you know, the correlations between yields and the market have broken down a little bit, because we've actually seen treasury yields come down in the last couple of weeks, even as some of those defensive sectors have also come down. So, you know, correlations may be breaking a little bit. I think that the medium term for treasury yields is kind of going to be range bound somewhat, but ultimately, you know, a move higher in yields is going to be, as long as it's not a spike higher, a surge higher, which we don't really see, that should be helpful or a tailwind to some of the sectors we talked about, financials, and that should also coincide with, you know, a bit of a pullback in or underperformance, if you will, in the consumer staples, utilities, and REITs that have been a beneficiary of the move in yields.
And now let's move on to some of the other indexes. One thing, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, was that we're starting to see stocks, not just here, but globally. We're seeing it in international, we're seeing it in Europe, we're seeing it in Asia, but also some of the indexes, like let's talk about some of the small caps and the importance of what may be happening here.
Right. So we know that a lot of indices have made new all-time highs, particularly in the U.S., but one index that has not is the small caps, the Russell 2000. We're actually still about 100 points below their 2018 high. And they actually, one interesting thing, they have not made a new 52-week high in over a year. The last time they made a 52-week high was in August 2018. So what we did is we looked back and we went back the entire history of the Russell 2000, which we have data back to around 1980. We looked at all times when it went at least a year without making a 52-week high, and then what happens once you actually do finally make that new first 52-week high in at least a year. And there's been about 11 times, there's been exactly 11 times when this has happened. When you make that first 52-week high, 10 of 11 times, the Russell has been higher 6 months later for a median gain of 13.4%. The only time where it was lower 6 months later was in 2002, which was in the midst of that of the end of the tech bubble bear market. So generally what that means is that we're looking for a new 52-week high in the small caps, and when and if and when we should get that, the next 6 and 12 months historically speaking, should be quite strong. So we're not quite there yet. We have to close above 1615 on the Russell 2000 index. We're flirting with that level, but I think as we look ahead into 2020, there could be a nice trade there. And also, that would coincide, in our view, with some outperformance from the Russell. So not only should it go up in absolute terms, but it's the fact that it's been underperforming the S&P over the last year, we think has high potential to actually reverse. So I think Russell can move higher and actually can do better than the S&P if we finally get that new high.
We talked about, let's say, interest rates rise on the 10-year, maybe not a big spike, but they begin to rise. That helps the banks because it helps their margins. Let's also talk about other sectors of the economy for confirmation. And let's take a look at oil and copper. What's your take on commodities?
So commodities, there's obviously a wide spectrum, and different commodities are sensitive to different things. But if we're talking crude oil, we actually think crude is pretty neutral here. It's got a flat 200-day moving average, meaning the long-term trend is not necessarily bullish or bearish. So we think when it gets down towards the low 50s, it's probably a buy, and towards the upper 50s, it's probably a sale for the foreseeable future. But what we know is that the energy equities have not really been tracking crude. They've actually done much worse. The worst performing sector on the S&P this year, and you know, whether they're caught up in some tax loss selling or what have you, the structural trend for energy stocks has been quite weak. But we do think that actually presents a short-term opportunity where you could see a relief rally, you know, as we head into early part of January, once that tax loss selling maybe is abated. So that's an area we'd be looking at for a trade, more so than an investment at this point. But as far as commodities go, so yeah, we think crude oil is pretty neutral. Gold and silver continue to kind of act okay, given that the market's been in what we'd call a risk-on mode since September. Gold and silver have not necessarily acted great. They also, you know, if we consider the move that they had into their summer highs, they've really just gone through a sideways consolidation. So we think gold, particularly the uptrend, is not done. It's just going to bide its time. It's consolidating gains. And ultimately, we think it can continue to move higher here. So we're keeping an eye on that. It's not necessarily anything that's super timely or actionable yet, but certainly I don't think the bull run is over in gold. Well, copper, we haven't followed as closely. You know, there's been a lot of talk on its correlations and what it means for the economy, but you know, we haven't found that much positive correlation of late for copper, so we don't really actively follow it that closely. It is kind of bounced off the lows, but to us, it just kind of looks range bound, I guess, similar to how we view crude oil here.
So given where we are right now, heading into a year-end rally, we've got things really kicking in. What would be your number one trade that you would have the most confidence in right now?
It would probably be the small caps. And again, they've literally gone sideways for most of this year. They had the rally off of the lows, like the oil market have gone sideways. They continue to kind of consolidate just below that key resistance level. And we have the confidence that history tells us once you make that first new high, forward returns are very strong. So I guess from a risk management perspective, you know, maybe you want to just do a small position here and then wait till you get confirmation on the breakout of that new high, because it, you know, it could happen next week, but it could happen next month, or even it could take a little longer. So, but we think, you know, history says, and just looking structurally speaking, we should see a nice move higher in the small caps. So we can't say exactly when it'll happen, but I think again, if we're looking ahead for trades for next year, it's a very strong possibility for some strength in small caps.
So Jonathan, with everything looking like it's breaking out globally, as an investor, would you just stay the course? And even though you might expect a short-term pullback in the short term, but stay invested?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, it's always tempting to kind of trade around and look for the pullbacks. And we do expect a pullback here, but you know, the question is how deep does that go? And again, if you take a step back, as we started the show looking 40,000 feet down, when an asset class has gone sideways for 2 years, particularly equities, and it just starts to break out, that can be powerful. And I think if you look back, the S&P, the last two times we've had a similar situation was kind of 2010 to 2012. We had the European crisis there, and we had the flash crash in there, and the S&P chopped around, had some big drawdowns for 2 years. And then we had a nice run from 2012 into 2015, that was about a 55% rally. And then 2015 through 2016, we had a similar thing where we just went sideways, had a bit of a shakeout in the summer of 2015, and then that kind of ended with the 2016 U.S. elections, and we had a nice run from the fall of 2016 into early 2018. So if you look at that kind of pattern, that's kind of the playbook that would make sense. So yeah, I think you want to probably stay the course and, you know, look for opportunities to buy into weakness, and, you know, we think we should be getting one as we head into early December.
Jonathan, final question. Next year is the fourth year of the presidential cycle. Historically, how well has the fourth year done compared to the third year? Because the third year, which we're in now, is doing pretty well.
Yeah, you know, there are those presidential historical patterns. Actually, don't have the data in front of me, but, you know, I think the fact that we're up so strongly this year maybe does take, to your point, maybe draws forward a little of the gains potentially from next year. But by our work, the current structural pattern is more important than the presidential cycle. And the structural pattern is that we've gone sideways for 2 years. So that actually lends itself to suggesting that maybe next year, at least the early part, can actually do fairly well, given that we've been in a trading or range bound market for the last 2 years. So I would look at that more so than the historical presidential pattern.
Okay, so conclusions, things are looking very good. Stay the course. Jonathan, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, we are an institutional broker dealer, so any institutional investors can certainly reach out. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter at Jake Krinsky PGA.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, thanks for joining us on the program. Happy holidays to you, and come back and talk again.
Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
This week, we spoke with Kurt Kalous at execspec.net about his outlook on the economy, U.S.-China trade, the very important December 15th deadline that is coming up. Here's a clip of what Kurt had to say.
The technicals were there ripe for a pullback. I don't think Hong Kong was a big factor. Could be an excuse. The put-call ratios were hitting probably the third highest level of call buying relative to put buying at its excessive optimism levels in over 5 years. It does make us vulnerable for a fall, and we are vulnerable to bad news. So if the 15th comes and tariffs are allowed to occur, stocks then, I don't think will happen, but stocks would then fall 5 to 10% pretty quickly back into the August-October trading range.
If you'd like to hear this full interview with Kurt Kalous, in addition to all of our other interviews with guest experts throughout the week, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
It's been a good year for investors. Doesn't matter where you're looking. Bonds have appreciated. Commodities, at least a couple of them, like gold and silver, have gone up. And even oil is holding steady. But the big winner so far has been the stock market. Almost the opposite of what we saw around this time last year, when just about every asset class was going down. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, let's begin with gold. You know, if we take a look at where gold has been this year, it took off at the beginning of the year. We had another nice upturn in gold this summer when the Fed announced it was cutting interest rates. It's now cut interest rates third time. But now, if you look at a chart, technicians will be familiar with it. It almost looks like a little flag formation, like it's maybe digesting a few things here. Let's begin with gold and your take where we go from here.
Sure, if I might draw back a little bit. We had a breakout level at 1350 that happened around June 10th of this year. And that was a six-year trading range. And I said on many interviews prior to that event that it was going to take, it had to get above that level for anything to really take off in gold. And it finally did. And it actually did quite well. It moved up about $200 in U.S. terms. And by the way, let me digress here a moment. Almost everybody probably listening to Financial Sense knows that gold has not done that well, but they think of gold primarily in U.S. dollar terms. But if you were looking at gold in almost any other currency, several of them, gold was hitting new highs, but the U.S. dollar price of gold was actually lackluster for, as I said, about 6 years. So it sort of depends on your perspective, and it has to do with, you know, how currencies move against each other. But let me come back. So we moved up from 1350 to 1550. It got a little ahead of itself. And since that time, which was about a little past August, early September, where we hit that high, gold's been consolidating. Now, it tried to hold the 1500 level for quite some time. I told my members well in advance that I expected to see a test of the 1450 level at least once, which it's done or very close to it. Normally, it's pretty, I wouldn't say easy, because technical work is not a science. It's an art, and it works some of the time, but there's no such thing as knowing all the time what the future holds. However, on a breakout like that after 6 years, it's pretty easy to expect a 50% retracement. So went up from 1350 to 1550. Half of that is 100 from the 200. Take it away from 1550 or add it to 1350, you come out with 1450. So that's what I expected. That's what we've seen. It's a hard call here to the end of the year, Jim, but I really think we're going to see sideways to lower to the end of this year.
Let's take a look at some of the other things that have been confirming this move, Dave. We've had an upturn finally in silver. You've got stock indexes. I mean, if you look at the gold stocks, if you look at silver, if you look at gold itself, the charts look pretty similar across the board. I know you keep in contact with bullion dealers. What are they telling you? Is the public coming into this, or has this been primarily hedge funds that are moving around in GLD or SLV?
It's been big money. The small guy, the smaller investor on net. In fact, one dealer, of course, I have to keep him anonymous, said that it's a 4-to-1 ratio. What's that? 4-to-1 means 4 times more sales to him to buy back gold than he's selling out. Now, again, this is the retail market. This is your smaller investor, whereas the larger investor, especially even the central banks, have gone in and bought gold pretty much double-fisted. But the small guy is not convinced this rally's for real. So a lot of them that bought gold, you know, under the 13 or above the 1350 level, say at 1400, they saw after 6 years, it's back to that level, making a 6-year high. I'm selling, you know, tell their wife I'm out, I'm done, I hate gold, or I bought too much. Now I'm down to, you know, 5% allocation, I rebalanced, or whatever the case may be. And that was a little disheartening to me, but it's also kind of good. I know I'm talking about both sides of my mouth, but what it means is the smart money's probably moving into gold rather substantially, and the public usually comes in late. I mean, the public loves to buy high-priced stocks. They love to buy high-priced gold. They like to buy high-priced everything, and then when it goes down, they sell low, so they end up with losses. And I know that sounds a little harsh, but believe me, I've been in this business for a long time, and that's a generally true statement. So that's what I see, or that's not even what I see, that's what I know from several dealers that I've talked to. Now, not all of them are this 4-to-1. There happened to be one in particular, but I was rather surprised at the result because I thought that a lot of retail would be coming back into this market. But we had a lot of overhead. We had a big overhang. And 6 years is a long time to wait. I mean, you know, I coined the phrase that silver will either scare you out or wear you out. Well, gold's done the same thing this time.
Dave, I want to talk about silver. Silver has done well this year. It's taken off. But one thing that I have always followed is this ratio between gold and silver. And right now, Dave, it's at 86. I haven't seen it this high, or at least stay this high. I mean, you could say yes. If you're in silver, you got to be happy because it's gone from 14, 15, it's up over 17, so you've made some money. But if you look at this ratio between gold and silver, is that a reflection, in your opinion, treating silver more as an industrial metal? Because a lot of the industrial metals, whether you're looking at copper or anything else, are kind of following this scenario about slowing global economic growth, the trade tensions, global growth slowing down. So why so high? Is this a reflection of basically being treated as an industrial metal?
It is. That's quite an interesting thought experiment. I'm not standing even right on this, but I'm going to start with nothing but fact. And after that's accomplished, then the listener can make up their own mind. But I probably put as much time into thinking about this gold-silver ratio as anyone. And I came to a conclusion that is, I think, you know, very obvious once you think about it. And again, you know, you can make up your own mind. But I looked at the gold-silver ratio going back into history. And if you go back to 3200 BC, so like almost 5,000 years ago, the gold-to-silver ratio in Egypt was 1 to 2.5. So it took 2.5 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. About 500 years later, it took 9 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold in Egypt. If you go back to Hammurabi in Mesopotamia, it's about 6 to 1. So if you go through the data, what you'll find is that the gold-silver ratio never got above 20 to 1 for like 4,000 plus years. And it's only been in the last 100 years plus, from the crime of 1873, where silver was demonetized, to present day, where silver was not used as money or considered money. It was used as money, excuse me, but not official money anywhere. And that's a little complicated to talk about because the Chinese were on the silver standard. But generally speaking, the U.S. wasn't on a silver standard after the 1873. Let me state that factually. Because of that, it was treated more as just a commodity, and the gold-silver ratio changed drastically over time. So now what my point is that if gold and silver were treated the same, in other words, if both were thought of as money primarily, then I think the ratio would be far lower than it is. And we've seen that when the monetary demand takes off. The Hunt brothers were not buying silver because it was good for cell phones in the future. They probably didn't know cell phones were going to exist. They were buying it for monetary purposes only. And due to that big influx of purchase power, it drove the gold-silver ratio back down to 16 to 1 momentarily. When we saw the big run in silver up through April, early May 2011, that was monetary demand. Then it drove the gold-silver ratio to about 35 to 1. So it's monetary demand. And again, I think the bankers knew, based on my pretty in-depth study of monetary history, that the banks wanted to make certain that silver wasn't part of the monetary system. In fact, if you dig deeper, what you'll find is the Wizard of Oz was totally a metaphor, an allegory, about going off of the silver standard and moving into the gold-only standard. It was by the economic establishment at the time. The Yellow Brick Road had everything to do with the gold-only path. And Dorothy wore silver slippers in the book. Ruby was only for the television. So this is something that it's worth contemplating if you're at least a silver bug, from the aspect of what could the monetary demand of silver be in the future. And I submit for your consideration that if we get into a position where people are starting to contemplate what the dollar might be worth in the future, or the bond market has a major hiccup and there's all of a sudden a larger monetary demand in the gold, the spillover in the silver could be quite substantial. And with that in mind, you might see silver actually outperform gold, which I do expect to take place. This is not a reason to buy nothing but gold and silver. It needs to be part of a balanced portfolio. 10% is probably enough for anybody. But the weighting right now in gold is about 1% of total assets. So that's even with, some really smart people telling you should allocate probably 10%. On aggregate, it's only about 1%. And silver is almost pathetic. It's hardly ever used as a monetary aggregate. I talked to Steve St. Angelo and I asked him to do a chart for my speech in the gold show in New Orleans recently. And in dollar terms, the gold is still held by central banks. Roughly 50% of the above-ground gold supply is still held by the banking system, even though they kind of poo-poo it in the financial markets when you talk to them officially on television or in the press. It's a pet rock. It's this, it's that. Watch what they do, not what they say, because they still hold it as a monetary asset, and it was moved to a tier one asset in the last several months. Silver doesn't hold that status, but if it did, it would be an interesting thought experiment, because the amount of silver in dollar terms, quote-unquote fiat terms, is 1/1,000th of what it is in gold terms. So what I'm saying is, you take gold, the amount held that's a fact, and looked at the dollar value of it, to get to the same dollar value in silver, you'd have to have a 1,000-fold increase. So you'd have to have 1,000 times more silver than they hold, and they hold a very minimal amount, or the price would have to go up 1,000. Of course, neither one of those is even logical or feasible. The point I'm making is that it's very undervalued relative to everything out there. And the problem the banks have, in a way, is that, as I did in an earlier video years ago, I think the biggest catalyst could be the silver market, believe it or not. And the reason being is they have less control because they don't own much physical. In the gold market, they still own enough that things got out of hand. And of course, they can always legislate, they can tax, they can use the rhetoric, use the mainstream media and everything else to kind of quell the markets. But if there is what I think could happen, and the demand goes to money and it's real money. In other words, you're fearing what the fiat system is doing. What's the demand? Well, I would think you could consider it's infinite demand. I mean, it's a demand that you can't really chart because it's not a once every 40 years or once every 200 year event like some of my colleagues state. This is like a once in a several lifetime event where the whole system comes into question. And it doesn't mean it fails. It means that it's questioned enough where people start to, and I don't like to use this fear word, but panic. And if they do, for a short time even, it could send this thing on a big spike. So I do look for silver to spike. I don't necessarily anticipate it to do in the circumstances I outlined. But my main point is for you to consider why the gold-silver ratio is where it is, what it really does mean, and whether or not you are a precious metals investor, you might want to rebalance. If you're overweight gold, you might swap it for silver. And I wouldn't be all silver or all gold. But I think one of the best asset allocation models out there was a permanent portfolio by my mentor, Harry Brown. And he did that permanent portfolio on a yearly basis. And he just rebalanced the portfolio every year between bonds, stocks, precious metals. And it worked out quite well. So end of the big diatribe, Jim, but thank you for letting me go on that.
Well, Dave, let me throw out two interesting questions here. Number one, silver as opposed to gold is consumed in a lot of applications. All these electronic devices we have, and I just don't see them scrapping iPhones to get the silver content. So silver's consumed as opposed to gold. Just about every ounce of gold that has ever been mined throughout history still exists today. It's either in a museum, in a central bank vault, or a ring or jewelry somewhere. Let's talk about that because silver could become scarcer. In other words, the gold that's been mined is still there. It exists. A lot of silver, as you and I know, is consumed in a lot of industrial applications. It used to be photography. Today, it's small electronics. That's number one. The other thing that I want to talk about is there is this movement of de-dollarization that's being headed by China, Russia, Iran, and some other countries because we've been using our financial muscle, whether it's trade wars or excluding people from the financial system. In China is moving to accumulate gold. There's speculation that they may back their currency or have some backing of gold. So let's talk about those two aspects and what impact do you think that'll have on metals?
Very good. Well, on the first one, you are basically correct, but that is changing. One of our speculations in my report has to do with electronic waste. And on a silver basis, Jim, you're right. You'd probably just throw it into the landfill. But because there's so much gold in the smartphones and the circuit boards, it's worth grinding them down. In fact, what's so amazing is if you took printed circuit boards and you took 1 ton of them, you have like about 12 grams per ton on average. Depends on, you know, there's different ones. But so it's actually richer in gold content than a lot of mines that are moving, you know, 1, 2, 3 grams per ton. So this speculation I have in the Morgan Report is quite an interesting story. It has to do with a cyanide replacement that leaches out the gold and the other precious metals. The main problem with the circuit happened to be how much copper is in these printed circuit boards. So during the process of learning how to do this to the most effective manner, it was determined that you really have to take the copper out before you even put it through the circuit. But it's quite a fascinating story. As far as China gold and Russia gold and moving gold from the west to the east, absolutely true. It's probably held in greater quantities than officially reported. And as far as the gold tie, it's hard to determine. I used to be more familiar with the idea that we would have to have some kind of gold tie to the next monetary system. I'm not as convinced as I once was, but certainly I don't rule it out entirely. I do think that the BRICS are doing their best in a way to move as far away from the dollar as possible, but they still really can't exit the system. There's just too much world trade that's done in dollars only, although they do a lot of trade exit the dollar. It's between themselves using their own currencies. Gold, I don't think, will have a role. Whether it's official or not remains to be determined. But there's a reason central banks are net buyers of gold. There's a reason China is importing so much, India is importing so much, and Russia is importing so much. They see what's coming. This is not a big mystery to the banking system. they know that the whole thing fails. In fact, this whole idea of compound interest that everybody's taught, the rule of 72 and everything else, which every financial planner knows by heart, is something that no one really considers in the long run. I just took you through a brief history of silver-gold ratio for 5,000 years. But if you just go back to when Jesus was born, if God had given him a nickel the time he was born and it was at interest for 2.5% for the last 2,000 years, in monetary terms and fiat terms, would be worth about 5 planet Earth. So obviously, you can't have a compounding interest go forever. The banks know it. I know it. But most people don't know it. And this is the problem with the bond market. Once you hit that exponential curve, you can't really claw your way back. You have to let the system do what it's going to do from the start, and that's fail. What does fail mean? It doesn't mean everything ends. All the wealth stays in place. Really, what happens is the ownership changes.
So given where we are today, Dave, we've got gold pulling back, silver pulling back, a lot of the industrial metals aren't doing well. What would you be doing as an investor? Would you be allocating a portion between gold and silver right now? You know, we've had experts on the program. They say anywhere from 5, no more than 10. What would you be doing?
Yeah, this is the time of year I like to rebalance my own portfolio. So, you know, I look at what the relationship is. As I said earlier, stocks, bonds, and precious metals. As I said earlier in the show, I would look at my gold-silver ratio personally, and depending on your age, look, it's a lot safer to be in the gold market than the silver market. I mean, no one knows that better than I. If you were like all gold, you might consider taking some silver depending on your risk tolerance, but you wouldn't want to overweight either, especially if you're, you know, in retirement years. So I'm building cash probably now at the end of the year. I'm looking for things that gets oversold during this tax loss season, basically from Thanksgiving onward to the end of the year. I usually do a trade in December into January, and I try to hold it as long as the market allows it, because there's usually some very juicy bargains, particularly in the small cap stocks, which I'm not a big fan of, but I follow them, where you can make rather significant gains if you know what you're doing. So I'm holding cash all the way through, Jim. I'm looking for bargains. I'm rebalancing. I'm trying to get rid of some of the stuff of the Morgan Report that I really hasn't performed as well as some others. And I'm going to try to narrow the list down a little bit. I don't like long lists. I have one of the shorter lists in the industry. Jay Taylor and I are friends, but Jay's got a lot of, you know, names on his list. And that's fine. Depends how you invest, what your philosophy is and everything else. Mine is, you know, keep it short, keep it simple, keep it where I could track these companies efficiently. And if they underperform, get rid of them and either keep them off or replace them with something that's better. So that's what I'm doing, Jim. I'm looking forward to a furtherance of this uptrend that we see in the gold and silver market. This pause that we're currently experiencing does not concern me whatsoever. It's actually healthy for the market. And just to repeat myself, and we used to talk about this quite often when, you know, gold had an 11-year run, one of the main functions of bull market is to shake a lot of investors off its back. A lot of people get discouraged on these consolidations, or they see a couple large down days in a row and they're out. The main idea is, as you said, get an asset allocation that you're comfortable with, 5% perhaps. And I think just buy and hold for most investors. Most people cannot trade effectively. And not that I'm the best out there. I'm probably one of the better ones. But even I never put in more than 25% total on my trading. I always keep my core position because, you know, it just takes one mistake where all of a sudden the market's running away from you. Most people are reluctant to get back in. I'm not, because I've done it so many times. But most people are. So if you keep that 75% core position, and sleep at night and don't worry about it. Most people that, as you well know, Jim, and I want to speak for you, got into gold when it was on that big run, they overallocated. And when they overallocate and things go the other way, the stock market takes off and they wish you're in the stock market, has to do with the fact that they didn't really have a balanced portfolio. And this is what people like you strive to do. And I have to, you know, tip my hat to you again, because, you know, you were a little earlier than I was for admitting that, you know, the gold market had, had its run and no one knew how long it was going to consolidate. Believe me, I thought 2 years, 3 at the most, and it was 6. So, you know, I had a little bit of a rough go there in my specialty because the market wasn't favorable to, you know, to the metals at the time. And now we're back and, you know, things are building back.
All right, Dave, as we close, if people like to follow your work at the Morgan Report, tell them how they can find out more.
Just go to the main page, themorganreport.com, get on our free email list. I do a weekly wrap-up every week that's only about 10 or 15 minutes long. I talk about I think the major news articles of the week are, has to do with a contracting economy on a global basis. Of course, there are spots in the U.S. that are doing better. But on aggregate, we're seeing some issues that you need to be aware of. Talk about the metals at the very end. And one thing I've been kind of pounding the table on is what the food supply is going to look like in the not too distant future. We have some real issues in the agricultures and even in the meat markets. So something that most people aren't aware of, it doesn't hit the mainstream very much. And since I've been sort of a commodities nut for most of my life, I do look at them all. I don't really trade in that market, but I certainly pay attention to it.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as always, pleasure to have you on the program. All the best, sir.
Thank you so much.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, last year at this time, markets were plunging. The Fed was hawkish. In fact, in November of last year, it's interesting because we were still talking about U.S.-China trade policy. And just like this year, when headlines suggested progress was being made in trade talks, stocks rose. When it appeared tensions had increased, stocks fell. But Jim, what is different this time?
You know, Chris, I think if there was a real turning point, it goes back to the beginning of the year, and it's attributable for the very same reasons the market was going down in the fourth quarter. It began in September when the market peaked of last year, and the Fed started giving speeches were nowhere close to neutral. That was followed by other speeches that, you know, basically QT was on automatic pilot. They raised interest rates twice going into the year. So they raised rates four times, and we got that huge plunge. Fast forward to the first weeks of the year, and they go, oh, by the way, we may change things. Because when we got to December, when the market hit a low, it was anticipated that the Fed was going to be raising interest rates three times this year. What have we gotten is three interest rate cuts instead. So the real pivotal changing point was, number one, the Fed doing a 180 in January and saying, hey, we're going to hold off. And then by the time we got to summer, they said they were hinting they were going to begin cutting, which is exactly what they did. And then also they were going to end the QT program in September, which was pulling money out of the market, which led to the problems that we had in September when we had a spike in the overnight rates, in the repo rates, when they went from almost 2% to 10%. And now, and we'll get to this shortly, the Fed poured $102 billion into the market. So once again, we're calling this segment the liquidity rush. Is basically the Fed is in the process of undoing every single thing they did last year. And that's what the big difference is.
Is that a good difference, Jim? I mean, because it seems like they sort of came to their senses. It seems like when they did make that 180, that everyone breathed a sigh of relief. So is this good? I mean, because we are seeing some other good things happening, like we see global PMIs improving. We see France at 5 months highs, the Eurozone's at a 3 month high. So are things looking good?
Well, we'll get to that shortly, but it is a good thing because, number one, you had this tremendous amount of fiscal stimulus that was put into the economy via tax cuts and additional $300 billion of government spending. So the one thing that was really kind of awkward last year is you have the government, the Fed has been on record, not only just Powell, but also Chairman Bernanke. Chairman Janet Yellen was always talking about, look, Congress, we can't carry the ball. You guys have to do something with fiscal stimulus. Well, that came in place in 2018 with the Trump tax cuts. But then all of a sudden, while the Trump is trying to stimulate the economy, the Fed is trying to tighten the economy. And a lot of people, including the president, were saying, why are you doing this? Number one, the economy is not overheating. Number two, there isn't a bubble. And number three, we don't have inflationary problems. So why are you guys doing this? Why are you being so aggressive? And the other thing that was happening at the same time, you were getting a double tightening. It just wasn't the fact that the Fed was raising interest rates. It was also the fact that the Fed was rolling over its balance sheet. It was contracting the money on Wall Street, which led to the problems that we had in the month of September when we had the spike in the repo rates. And that's one thing the Fed's trying to correct right now. So yes, I think it was a good thing because I think the harsh tightening was out of sync with fiscal policy. And that's the first time, quite honestly, in my almost four decades in the business, Chris, that I've seen that monetary policy going in the opposite direction in fiscal policy. They normally work in conjunction and support each other. So, you know, thank goodness they made the 180-degree turn.
Jim, going back to me alluding to what was happening in Europe, for example, how does that tie in to what we're seeing in looking at this year and what's happened the last 12 months? I mean, does, for example, global PMIs improving? To what extent does that impact us?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at PMIs in Europe, in fact, Germany, their PMIs just hit a five-month high. France hit a five-month high. The Eurozone hit a three-month high. Because remember all the talk, what have we been talking about the market this year? We've been talking about two things, the trade war with China and the U.S. and a global slowdown and what the Fed was doing. So now we've got central banks around the globe, including our own Fed, that are cutting interest rates. I think it's like 26 or 30 central banks that have made interest rate cuts this year. So now we're starting to see the PMIs go in the opposite direction. We just got resale, home resales for the month of, October? And they're up like close to 1.9%. So this pickup, and we're also seeing this reflected in stock markets. As I was talking with Jonathan Krinsky earlier in this broadcast, we're talking about it's not just U.S. stocks. Actually, European stocks are doing much better. Stocks are up in Asia. The emerging market stocks are up. So we're seeing a global recovery in stock markets that began ahead of what we are now starting to see is a pickup in the PMIs. Now, are we off to the races again economically? I don't think so. In fact, the latest projections, the World Bank and the IMF are projecting that next year global growth will slow down to about 2.9% for the globe versus their original forecast of 3%, which has been downgraded from 3.5%. And they're projecting that the U.S. economy next year will slow down to 2% versus 2.3% for this year. So what has happened as a result of our own Fed, the ECB, and other central banks cutting, they basically were going in the wrong direction, and it looked like the economy was probably going to roll over globally. We saw negative prints quarterly for Germany in their economy. Now, what has happened, Chris, the best word we can say, things have stabilized, and that's being reflected in just about all the stock markets around the globe.
There's so much going on that's interesting, because with the stock market at all-time highs, it's interesting because the Wall Street Journal had a cover story article on Friday. It was titled Bridgewater Bets Big on Market Drop. Now, this is big because Bridgewater, I mean, that's the world's largest hedge fund. And if they're using options to wager what could amount to the beginning of the end, if I can put it that way, what's your take on this, Jim? This is a sobering article.
Well, yeah, it was a headline article, and it was saying basically the world's largest hedge fund and one of the smartest guys on the planet was making a big billion-dollar bet against a stock market fall by March of next year. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, Bridgewater had assembled a reverse market position executed by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley that would pay off big time if the S&P 500, the Euro Stock 50 Index, both went into decline. But Dalio came back and countered and says, that's not true. And he said, look, in this age of, you know, basically fake news and newspapers trying to grab headlines, he said, we have no net short position. In other words, if you look at Bridgewater's portfolio, they're not really short the market. And I think maybe what they were picking up on, and let me explain this. Let's say I'm managing, let's just make the math simple. I'm managing $100 billion. And let's say I'm long the market. But I want to hedge that position because what if I'm wrong? What if the market turns as it did in the fourth quarter? What if Powell or the Fed all of a sudden changes direction or some unforeseen event, I'm going to hedge my position. How would I do that? Well, I might take buy out of the money puts on the S&P or the Euro Stock Index. And if I really have a big, big long position, I would hedge that with puts. And so maybe what was happening here was the interpretation is that, hey, Bridgewater's got $1 billion in puts or some kind of adverse market position. They're betting big on a market downturn. That's not exactly what they're doing. What I suspect they're doing, they're long the market. And what this was simply a hedge. Sometimes we'll do that. We did that, for example, in 2010. We had a very long position in the market and we took out puts covering 50% of our portfolio, which paid off handsomely with the flash crash. But we were doing it, Chris, as a hedge against a very long position. And remember, there was a lot of uncertainty going on in 2010 and 2011. So a lot of times, if you have a long position and you're thinking, you know, what if I'm wrong? How do I hedge that? I might do a put. And I think that's what Bridgewater did.
Well, and that's an important distinction, Jim. I appreciate you bringing clarity to that. Jim, as the stock market continues to power on, there seem to be forces that shape the stock market. And one of those that you've brought up in recent episodes of the Financial Sense NewsHour, it has to do with Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and how you believe this tends to cast a potential shadow over the markets. Do you think it's doing that now when we're seeing such strength in the markets? And if not, when do you anticipate that we'll see the market really impacted by what's being proposed?
Well, Chris, it's not just us. There was an article in the Financial Times on Thursday, and it basically said Wall Street powers on, but with less and less conviction. They were talking about basically two drivers right now. One is the TINA trade or the FOMO trade. TINA stands for there is no alternative to stocks. Basically, if you look at the yields on treasuries, they're going lower, obviously, with money pouring into our market, the Fed cutting interest rates. So what else is there? We're actually getting better yields in stocks than we're getting in bonds. There's still this global search, whether you're a hedge fund, whether you're a pension fund, looking for places to get higher yields. I mean, in our income portfolio, we're getting yields of 4, 5, and 6% in a market that has treasuries below 2%. So the TINA trade, there's also what is called the FOMO trade, which is fear of missing out. So we pointed out in earlier broadcast, there's a ton of money on the sidelines. A lot of people are just saying, well, I'm going to wait for this market to pull out. And when I get that pullback, then I'll invest. Well, it's not happening. And so that is one force shaping the market. Now, the other is Elizabeth Warren. And as the Times pointed out, there are five things that the markets are fearful of. One, she has threatened to break up the big banks. So that creates instability, increase antitrust, disrupt the healthcare system, limit fracking, and dismember the technology giants, and then also basically confiscate through a wealth tax a half to two-thirds of the wealth of the country's billionaires. In fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. I think Bill Gates would drop from $100 billion under Warren's plan down to $30 billion. I mean, he's still going to be well off. Warren Buffett would lose about two-thirds of his wealth. But also, there would be a financial transaction of about a half a percent. So anytime you bought a stock, anytime you bought a bond, or you sold something, you would pay a half a percent of the value in a financial transaction. I don't think that's a big enough force yet because we still don't know. I mean, it's just amazing. There's two additional people today on Friday. Mike Bloomberg announced his candidacy for president on the Democratic Party. So we still don't have a clear candidate. But as we get closer into next year, and if Warren emerges as the number one candidate, then I think this is going to have a negative impact on the market because it would devastate the market. It would probably collapse the economy and the markets if she was to follow through with what she's proposing. So right now, as the Times pointed out, those are the two big factors. I would probably disagree with the Financial Times. It's too early to say the Warren effect. I've talked about it. We just had a guy that's worth $50, $60 billion just enter the Democratic race. So we got another billionaire in the race. There is no clear candidate yet. But the top candidates so far are still Biden, there's still Sanders, and there's still Warren, as we covered that in the Morgan Stanley report several weeks ago on the show.
And as we talk about just the general health of the market, the Fed, since September's rate crisis, the Fed's been injecting hundreds of billions into the market. Now, it's interesting because some people say, okay, don't worry, look what they're doing. Other people are saying it may not be enough to calm lending conditions. What's your take, Jim?
Well, I mean, they pledged to put $60 billion a month into the market all the way to the end of second quarter of next year. If you look at what that adds up to, Chris, they basically undo QT. The Fed shrunk its balance sheet by $600 billion. By the time we get to next summer, they would basically add that back. And it's working. It's creating liquidity. It's helping them keep Fed funds rate where they want it to be. I mean, this week alone, they added $102 billion in the repo market and liquidity. And once again, what are we seeing? We're seeing the stock market at all-time record lows. When you're short of cash, you run into problems, which is what was starting to happen in September when we had that spike where the Fed funds rate went from 2 to 10% in a single session. So that is helping the market, and it's creating liquidity, which is why you're seeing the markets respond favorably. The markets love liquidity. This market runs on liquidity.
Jim, it was reported just a few days ago in the New York Times that FedEx cut its tax bill all the way to zero. If I'm not mistaken, I think they had paid previously $1.5 billion in taxes. They lobbied hard to get the new tax bill. They got it, and they cut its tax bill actually to where the government owed FedEx money. But they had promised that they were going to do a lot of spending, and that was going to be the benefit to American business, to the economy. But why is it, Jim, that corporations, they don't seem to be spending money?
There's a couple of reasons. Number one, a lot of the companies that make up the S&P 500, our Dow 30 stocks, are multinational corporations. What are we seeing? What have we been talking about this year? The trade war, the slowdown in PMIs up until recently, economic growth slowing down. So if you're a company, Chris, why would you go out and build a new factory if you don't even know what this trade law is going to settle? In fact, there was another article in the Wall Street Journal this week and the Financial Times talking about global supply chains are being changed and it's hurting China. A lot of companies are now going to Vietnam. They're going to other places. And if you're an international company, let's say, I don't know, you're 3M or you're IBM, you're General Motors, and you've got factories around the globe and you've got a supply chain, you don't know where this is going. This is creating uncertainty and it is impacting the manufacturing sector. The second thing, you've got to have demand to spend money. And so you've got to have a robust economy. If you are in a corporation and your economists are saying, hey, the U.S. economy is slowing down, our PMIs are slowing down, the global PMIs are slowing down, why in the heck would you expand unless you're getting an order flow that's coming in? And we saw this with even our ISM new orders. A lot of this was starting to decline. So that's one reason. The second reason, a lot of our companies today are technology companies that require less capital. In other words, they're more technologically driven, which takes less capital than, let's say, the old industrial type stocks. So it's one reason why you're seeing a lot of corporations that are investing, but they're not investing as much as was thought of by economists if you stimulate with tax cuts, because, Chris, you have to have demand. I'm not going to expand a business unless my marketing people tell me, say, guys, everything we've got in the warehouse is sold. We need to produce more. And if we can't produce more, we need to build another factory. You're not going to do that unless the demand is there.
And Jim, that article I mentioned from the New York Times, it said that FedEx spent more than $2 billion on stock buybacks and dividend increases in the 2019 fiscal year. What's the other side of buybacks? Why are they seemingly not as cracked up as they appear?
Well, you know, on the surface, one of the biggest buyers in this market has been corporate buybacks. But the story isn't what it appears to be. I'm against buybacks unless your stock is so beaten up, you've got a lot of cash, it's unfairly and undervalued in the market, then you enrich shareholders by buying your stock back at a lower price. But what is happening, Chris, and it was amazing. It just wasn't the Wall Street Journal that picked up on this, but it was also the Financial Times as well. Let me give you an example. Microsoft. Microsoft spent the last 12 months spending $16.8 billion to buy back 150 million shares of stock. But what they forgot is they issued 116 million shares to employees. So employees are enriching themselves through stock options. And so in order to keep the company from being overly dilutive, they're going back and buying shares. So let's say the company issues 100 million shares. Well, then they go back in and they buy those shares. And in this case, they issued 116 million shares to top management and board of directors. And Microsoft went back into the market and bought 150 million shares. So you've got CEOs that are becoming billionaires by running companies. Jamie Dimon owns 7 million shares of JP Morgan worth over $950 billion. Tim Cook, Al Gore on the board of Apple, sold $38 million worth of stock in 2017. He just got $21 million of stock option grants as a director. So at one point, Elizabeth Warren has a point that some of these guys are enriching themselves. A lot of these stock buybacks have not gone to really reduce the amount of shares outstanding. It's really going to cover the amount of shares that are being issued to board of directors, CEOs, and upper management, which is enriching them.
And Jim, what would need to happen for a risk trade to emerge?
You know, right now, one of the things that's probably keeping this market from really going ballistic is probably the strength of the dollar. Because if you take a look at your Dow 30 companies, your S&P 500 companies, Fortune 500 companies, they're international companies, strong presence overseas. Well, if the dollar, if I'm Coca-Cola and I'm getting 80% of my sales from overseas, the dollar appreciates. That means as a company, when I translate my European sales, my Japanese sales, my Chinese sales back into dollars, I lose money. And that's one where you've seen several companies not only issue trade issues as the number one reason they're missing estimates, but the other thing has been the strong dollar. And you always hear Trump tweeting anytime the dollar gets strong because he knows that impacts corporate profits. When will that happen? It will happen when the Fed goes beyond. And right now, the market, the Fed is giving the message, look, we're sort of on hold. We've cut it three times. I think there's only like an 8 or 10% chance they'll cut next month. So, but, you know, the market is pricing in maybe one more cut. It's only when the Fed really starts getting into a rate cutting mode. And as we have pointed out in previous shows, if they start doing that, that means the economy's in trouble. So a strong dollar would help corporate profits. And it would help corporate earnings. So it's one factor that's been weighing in on a lot of these companies that are represented in the S&P and the Dow.
Well, and this has been a really interesting conversation, Jim, because you have mentioned just a number of dynamics that explain where the market and why the market is where it is today. Based on all of that, though, Jim, what are the folks at the firm doing?
You know, we've increased our equity position, not only here, but also internationally, given this liquidity drive. And fortunately, we had the cash to do that. In our income accounts, Chris, we're buying dividend-paying stocks that have been beaten up. They're down 25, 35%. And we've been getting dividend yields from 3.5% all the way to over 6%. We're just about ready to pick up another technology company when we do. And when it gets to our price range where we want to buy it, it'll be down about 30%. The dividend yield will be closer to 4%. That's kind of the things that we like on the income side. We've been also buying preferred stocks with 5 and 6% yields. So, you know, I like this kind of market where selectively, believe it or not, folks, a lot of companies, a lot of sectors have been going through their own bear markets, and that's where we've been looking.
And Jim, what is coming up in the weeks ahead?
Well, let me see. Next month we have, we got Black Friday. Next Friday kicks off the Christmas buying season. So everybody's going to be watching what retailers are doing. It isn't looking too good. Macy's just reported a miss and they lowered their estimates. I still think the trend of online buying is superseding and growing at a faster rate than brick and mortar. So we have the Christmas shopping season, or what we call Black Friday, when retailers finally go into the black. We've also got the Fed meeting in December, low probability of raising interest rates. And then, of course, we've got the impeachment hearings. Democrats have vowed to remove this president from office, so it's very likely the House is going to vote for impeachment. So December, we also have the IG report. that shows there could be criminal charges within the high ranks of government. So we've got that coming up. And probably, I suspect, Chris, we will kick off the beginning of the year with an impeachment trial in the Senate. So lots of stuff to keep your eyes on. The best thing we could say right now, the market's in an uptrend. A lot of money is flowing into this market via Fed injections, and that should keep this market on an uptrend. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.